Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy like health care, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and candidates on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. We continue with our series focused on candidates for Congress in New Hampshire's 1st and 2nd districts. Over the next several weeks, you will hear from both Republican and Democratic candidates. In one-on-one interviews, each will have an opportunity to share their background, experiences, and policy priorities. They will also answer questions related to the nation's fiscal challenges and how, as members of Congress, they might work to resolve them. This week, you will hear from 2nd District Congressional Candidate Lynn Blankenbecker, and then Concord Coalition's Policy Director Josh Gordon will join the show to discuss the Congressional Budget Office's recent reports on economic forecasts, as well as alternative scenarios in its long-term budget outlook. But before we dive into today's discussions, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. In June, the CBO warned the national debt was headed to heights never before experienced in the U.S., on pace to equal 150% of the nation's economy within 3 decades. In a report issued last week, however, the CBO made its bleak forecast even more grim. The CBO's baseline projections from June assumed current policies would remain unchanged, as if that wasn't bad enough. CBO's alternative scenario, issued just last week, reflects policy changes that might be more in keeping with reality, such as recent tax cuts not expiring and spending limits being busted yet again, which would result in projected debt levels reaching 210% of GDP within 30 years. Congress certainly seems poised to make matters worse before they make it any better. Speaking of spending limits, the Defense Department experienced increases of $80 billion in fiscal year 2018 and $85 billion in fiscal year 2019, but it is preparing to tighten its belt in 2020 when sequestration under a 2011 deficit reduction law is expected to be reinstated. Defense officials are concerned that without another budget deal that addresses sequestration, their budgets could actually shrink. In fiscal year 2020, federal agencies could spend as much as $2.25 billion fighting fires, and do so without worrying about breaching caps because of a law passed by Congress in March that exempts fire suppression funding from spending limits imposed on discretionary accounts. The move was aimed at ending the practice of, quote, fire borrowing, in which the Forest Service has to raid money from other accounts it controls to pay for fire suppression when its firefighting budget runs dry. But since the new funding arrangement doesn't take effect until fiscal year 2020, a little more borrowing might be needed in order to combat wildfires currently devastating parts of California. The Carr Fire in California's Shasta County has burned over 177,000 acres so far, with 820,000 acres burned across the state already. The Forest Service expects to deplete its remaining funds at a rapid rate. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. Up next, I will be joined on the show by New Hampshire congressional candidate Lynn Blankenbecker. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by New Hampshire congressional candidate Lynn Blankenbecker. Lynn lives in Concord with her husband. She has served as a nurse in the Air Force and Navy Reserves with multiple deployments in the Middle East. She's currently the commanding officer of the Navy Reserve Medical Unit assigned to Navy Medical Center San Diego and recently served as a key policy advisor at the Pentagon and Defense Health Headquarters. Lynn also served 2 terms in the New Hampshire House of Representatives. She's running as a Republican to represent the 2nd Congressional District of New Hampshire. Thank you for joining the show, Lynn.
Thanks so much, Chase. It's a privilege and a pleasure to be here with you today.
And we're happy to have you on Facing the Future. Appreciate you taking the time to be on the show. And I think before we jump into anything particularly fiscal policy oriented, I want to give you a chance to introduce yourself to our listeners and maybe explain why you're running for Congress and what some of your top policy priorities might be.
Sure. Well, thank you. And you know, you did a great job reading out my resume, and a resume is a large reason for why I'm running. As you mentioned, my most recent assignment on active duty in the military was when I was at the Pentagon and when I was at the Defense Health Headquarters, and it was there that I was working on healthcare policy. But I had this interface with Congress as I answered requests for information from Congress to the admirals that I was serving for, and what I noticed was this, just the dysfunction that was going on in Congress. Having that front row seat to the infighting and the bickering and the gridlock that was caused by that and what it was doing to our national security really had me concerned. I don't know if you know this, but the Pentagon is about 60% civilian employees and about 40% military. And every time there is a government shutdown or a continuing resolution or a furlough or a sequestration, you know, those civilian workers can't come to work. Now, I don't know about you, but when 60% of your employees can't come to work, that really puts a dent in your productivity during the day. And the Pentagon, as you can imagine, has a very interesting mission. We allocate money for our military. We strategize for our military. You know, there's a lot of things that we do all through the Department of Defense there. And those 60% are key people that have key information. And so when they can't come to work, it really, you know, chips away at what we can do, which chips away at our national security. So for me, I thought, you know, I've worn a uniform at that time. It had been, what, almost 30 years by the time I decided to, 32 since when I decided to run. I thought 32 years of working alongside a million other people who wear 5 different uniforms and they come from every walk of life. We all come with a lot of differences in religion and our political leanings. But, you know, at the end of the day, we all roll up our sleeves and we do one thing, and that's protect and defend this nation and defend our Constitution. And so I thought if a million people in a uniform can do that, 435 people in Congress can do that. And that's the ethos I would like to bring to Congress so that we can get like-minded people just like me who are ready to protect this country, defend our Constitution, and work towards those initiatives to taking our country forward and ensuring that we have national security, which leads me to my priorities. You know, I'm a problem solver and I'm a leader. And so I think strong leadership and strong problem solving skills are going to be key in Congress. Because so many of our issues are intertwined. You know, if you talked about the opioid crisis, for example, you can't talk about opioids without talking about immigration, without talking about health care. And so we need to look at all of those pieces and how they're intertwined. And so for me, I'd like to bring those strong problem-solving skills and those strong leadership skills to be able to look at the issues in their entirety and not in just isolation. But immigration is very important to me. For the reasons I spoke about, obviously, healthcare is very important to me. Having been a healthcare provider for 32 years, you can imagine that's an issue for me. Balancing a budget, that's a priority for me. We haven't had a balanced budget since 2006. The current Congress is resorting to sit-ins, government shutdowns, temper tantrums, whatever you want to call them, instead of balancing a budget. And we need to look at that. And the deficit. I mean, the issues go on and on. So I'll stop talking and let you ask.
We could have
question.
A nice long monologue here. So I'll jump in with a question. You mentioned a wide array of policy priorities you'd have if you were in Congress as well. Let's go to your bread and butter for a moment and talk a little bit about health care. It's no secret that it's an expensive system in our country. We spend as a nation about 20% of our GDP on health care as a whole. The trustees for the Medicare system have come out and said that it's in some financial trouble. What would be your approach on healthcare to help control some of the cost growth? Do you think some major reform needs to occur in the system as a whole and Medicare specifically? What's your take here?
Well, let's start with, you know, just our healthcare in general. You know, we need healthcare in this nation that's affordable, that's accessible, and that's accountable. The Affordable Care Act was none of those. Cookie cutter health insurance doesn't work for a nation. let's look at just the people in this room, me and you. We both have very different healthcare needs. And so why should the insurance plan that you buy be the same insurance plan that I buy? You wouldn't do that for your car.
And for those listening, I have a six pack. I'm in very peak physical condition.
And I am not.
Only kidding.
No. So, you know, we need to open up those lines of interstate commerce where folks can go across state lines and purchase the insurance that they need, what meets their needs and their family's needs, and so they get the coverage that they need. We certainly need to get control of Big Pharma. Look at the Fortune 500 companies. Who are they? McKesson, AstraZeneca, you know, all these pharmaceutical companies. There's no doubt that the outrageous cost of medication in this country is a problem, and that's right, driving up the cost of healthcare. That comes from overregulation, that comes from, you know, bureaucracy, and that comes from, you know, greed. And so we need to look at that. We certainly need to look at tort reform. Tort reform is driving the cost of education up and is driving accessibility down. When you look at folks who won't go into private practice because they can't afford the cost of their malpractice insurance, or folks who don't even choose to go into the practice of medicine anymore or in healthcare at all because they can't afford the expensive schooling and then this expensive healthcare, malpractice premium on top of that, that drives the cost of healthcare up and drives our accessibility down. There's so many facets to why we have the healthcare problem in this nation, and we need to, you know, start looking at all those pieces of it and breaking that down so that we can drive healthcare for the people. You know, it's outrageous that we are the United States of America. We should have the best healthcare system, the best quality of healthcare. And I don't understand how you can send somebody to Congress who has no healthcare experience whatsoever and try to get them to fix the healthcare problem.
So, Lynn, you also mentioned something earlier on in your remarks about leadership and working together with others. In the discussion here about healthcare, you mentioned how the ACA, from your perspective, isn't working or is too costly. So taking a leadership role in healthcare reform, what kind of replacement or reform would you engage in that particular aspect of the system? Do we need something like an expanded Medicare system? Do you need a more privatized system? What is a replacement or alternative, in your view, for the ACA?
Well, I don't think the government should be in the business of healthcare delivery in this nation, and so I would look more to putting that back out into the private sector like it used to be, and letting folks be able to purchase competitively for their insurance and their healthcare needs. So I'm glad that some of those, what I believe, were horrible mandates on folks to purchase insurance or be taxed. That was terrible. And it didn't improve the healthcare in this nation, and it certainly didn't make it affordable, and you never got to keep your provider. The government doesn't need to be doing that. And like I said, a government program is going to require cookie-cutter healthcare, and we all have different healthcare needs, so that doesn't work. As far as Medicare, you're talking about Medicare or Medicaid or both systems, you know, as far as expansion of those, there's no doubt that there's some obligation to care for, you know, our most vulnerable in this nation. And certainly folks are at times in their lives when they need help, you know, no doubt. But we need to look at that program, and we need to look at a number of things. Or we need to look at age requirements. Are those still realistic anymore? We need to look at means testing. Is that still, you know, should we be looking at means testing? The president just put in a sort of work mandate, right? Like work a little to get a little. And I think that's healthy. That's positive. People who are working feel good about themselves. They go to work. They do something positive. They contribute to their community and to their workforce. And they earn their own money. And who doesn't feel good about that?
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking with New Hampshire congressional candidate Lynn Blankenbecker. We're discussing her policy priorities as well as her take on the nation's fiscal challenges. And this might be a good time, Lynn, to transition to another topic of probably particular interest to you, and that is, say, discretionary spending. And part of that is spending on national security and defense. When you look at trends within the federal budget as a percentage of the economy, spending on defense and other areas of domestic investment have actually been going down as the economy grows. So even if we're looking at nominal dollars going up, it's not growing at the rate as the economy or even other areas of spending. So when you're in Congress and talking about the budget process and appropriations, are there any particular areas of investment that'll be a high priority for you? And if it requires spending more, how do you pay for it?
Sure. Well, first of all, I want to make it crystal clear. I don't believe in new taxes, and I don't believe in raising taxes. I believe that you live within the budget that you have. And so when you have a bloated budget and then you try to tax people to cover that, that doesn't work. And so we need to look at where we're, just like we do in our household, where we're going to spend our money and what's the best bang for our buck, right? And, I think national defense is something I'm very familiar with because I've worked in the military for 32 years, so I'm familiar with that. There's no doubt that there's places that we can look to trim and ways that we should be looking to plus up. We have training needs, and I think from a readiness perspective with our military, we need to make sure that the training is robust. We certainly have equipment needs. Our equipment in the military is very, very expensive. I don't know if you've tried to buy a fighter plane lately, but those are quite costly.
I haven't had a particular need for a fighter plane, but it sounds like an interesting purchase.
Right. So, so those are very costly items, but we need to make sure that we're putting our pilots into good equipment that's modern, that's in good service, and we can't put people at risk. You can imagine when one of those goes down what the human cost is for that. And so we need to look at that, make sure that we're staying up on technology, not just airplanes and ships, but, our electronic warfare and all of those areas where we are at cutting edge. We are the world's superpower. We need to stay that superpower. And so defense is very important to me. But there's no doubt that there's a budget out there, and I'm sure there are places where there's maybe spending that should go a different direction or maybe spending that shouldn't be done at all. I will tell you that when I have the budget before me, the one that I'll be responsible for looking at and voting on, I will take a very close look at that. There's all kinds of facets. I think there's some agencies that are outdated that we may not need anymore or we may not need as robust anymore because of we've met the intended goal of the agency. There may be agencies that need to be plussed up because we're a new society now and things have changed, right? And so I think we need to look at all those.
You also mentioned something earlier about taxes and how you wouldn't want to see any new taxes. But we just recently went through a bout of tax reform in Congress, and most economists see that as potentially increasing budget deficits by about $1 trillion over 10 years, even factoring in economic growth. So I'm curious, if you were in Congress at the time, would tax reform have looked different for you? Are there any aspects of tax reform you'd want to engage on if you are representing the 2nd District as of November?
Well, I can tell you that tax reform is working for the state of New Hampshire. First of all, unemployment is down. The economy is much better. And I will tell you that I'm out knocking on doors every single day. And recently, just last week, I was knocking on doors in the Salem area. And I knocked on this one gentleman's door, and he asked me how I felt about President Trump. And I said, well, I think some of his policies have been excellent for the state of New Hampshire. For example, his tax reform. The man stepped out of his house. He gave me a giant bear hug. And he said to me, do you know that with tax reform, my wife now makes $100 more a week? And he said, part of that is my tax savings. But another part of it is her employer gave her a raise. And he said, for the first time ever, I'm able to buy a new car for my family. Now, think about just one man, one person in Salem, right? The boss of the job was able to give people raises. People are now able to buy new cars, which means they're putting gas in those cars, which means they're driving those cars to places that hopefully are buying more stuff with that extra $100 a week. And so our economy is only going to get better. It can't get worse. And so I think this has been great for the economy. And I'm excited to see where the long-term effects go with this as our country continues to grow and prosper.
Lynn, just to follow up on that, do you think economic growth coming out of the tax reform will be enough to bridge the deficit divide that
No.
we're currently experiencing?
No.
Is there, what would be your take on, since you talked about balancing the budget, how do you get there from here? We're looking at $1 trillion deficits, which is a big number. And even as a percentage of GDP, that mm-hmm. percentage is growing. So it's clearly an issue that needs to be tackled by Congress. And so if we're not looking at new taxes, what's the approach?
Sure. And I think you have to look at the two things in isolation. We've got this $21 trillion of deficit, and then we've also got, the budget. And you can't even begin to tackle the deficit when you can't even balance a budget. The deficit just continues to grow when you can't balance a budget. So for me, the first order of business when I get to Congress, I cannot eat the whole elephant at once. I've got to start biting this off in small chunks. And the first small chunk is to make sure we get control of our budget so we don't increase the deficit. Once we get control of that budget, then we can look at creative ways to bring that deficit down.
And how might you go about trying to control the budget? I'm assuming that comes from the process itself. I think there's a joint committee right now between the House and the Senate looking at areas that they might be able to reform that process to maybe hold Congress's feet to the fire a little bit more on engaging in that process more fully. Are there aspects of it that you would change? Are you looking to that committee to sort of produce some of the solutions?
Well, I think the committees do their good job, getting to solutions. But I will tell you something. The one of the things that's killing us in this nation are government shutdowns and continuing resolutions and turning their back on facing this budget that we have to balance. And so for me, you know what I'd change? I'd change the sit-ins. I'd change the resistance movements. I'd change the infighting. I'd change the continuing resolutions. I'd change the government shutdowns. And I would do the work that the people of America expect us to do.
And is that more of a leadership change?
Absolutely.
Let's move on to another pretty big topic. We're talking about the budget itself. Social Security is a big piece of the pie. It's another particular area of spending where its trustees have come out and said it's, careening toward insolvency in terms of its trust funds. In fact, if we wait until 2034, when it's expected to be insolvent, you're looking at a 24% benefit cut for all beneficiaries across the board. So are there particular reforms you'd like to see in Social Security to help stabilize it? Do you think we're at sort of a generational transition since this is largely a demographic-caused issue? How would you approach Social Security? Do you think changes need to be made?
I think that we have to look at everything. Everything is on the table to look at now. And we'd be remiss if we didn't investigate every opportunity to preserve Social Security and change Social Security so that it is a sustainable product down the road, if that's the intent and where we want that to go. And so things that I think that would be on the table, we need to look at means testing. We need to look at age. We need to look at, maybe privatizing for future beneficiaries or those sorts of things. So we need to put everything on the table and take a hard look and weigh in the balance where we think we want to go with Social Security. But you are absolutely right, and I think you hit the nail absolutely on the head when you identified that if we don't do something, this is not going to be liquid for long.
You mentioned some of the things that we should look at in reforming Social Security. Do you have sort of a package of policies that you already have in mind that you'd pitch as a solution? Or is this something you'd rather explore when you're in Congress?
No, I absolutely want to explore it. And I don't think that that's an exhaustive or an all-inclusive list. I am so open to ideas on how we can make this better. I have a unit of 877 Navy Reserve Medicine sailors. And if you polled any of my sailors today and asked them, about my leadership and my ability, my style, they will all tell you, Captain Blankenbecker opens the table for all suggestions. And we listen to all suggestions that we think can take this unit forward and make it better, better for the morale, better for training, better for, there's all kinds of aspects of what makes a good unit. And I believe in that. I believe in taking all ideas to the table. Some of them are going to be, impossible. Some of them are going to be nice twos but too expensive, or nice twos but can't because of. And then others are going to be great ideas that people have thought of that were way out of the box. But, hey, that's a great idea, and let's try it. And so I would do the same thing in Congress. We need to put all ideas on the table and try to go to move towards success.
And just to follow up on that, Lynn, how do you cut through the rhetoric in Congress as a leader? You're talking about working as a unit, as a team in the military, where everyone is sort of perceived as on the same page, on the same team. And in Congress, it seems very much unlike that. So how do you take those leadership skills and create a sense of bipartisanship to tackle a lot of the issues we've been discussing?
Oh, well, I think, one of the things that we have is the power of the Constitution. And I'm really grateful for that document. Because in our Constitution, in the enumerated articles, it lays out really basically a job description for what Congress is supposed to do. And so I think if we can get back to what Congress is supposed to be sticking to, that's maintaining our national defense, maintaining our streams of interstate commerce, those sorts of things, and get away from some of those polarizing issues that cause people to sit on the House floor and you know, and throw DACA temper tantrums when they should be balancing a budget, we will be able to get to the work that the people certainly the people of the Granite State and certainly the people of the United States of America expect us to. You know, in the military, we are given regulations, guidelines, and we have a mission. And we know where we're headed. And so we fit within those regulations and guidelines, and we move towards the mission accomplishment. And so while other people may have ideas, we don't stray off and start going down rabbit holes of things that are not directly related to the mission. And we just got to keep Congress mission focused. You know, I always say, in the military, we take an oath to protect and defend this country and to protect and defend the Constitution. Congress takes a very similar oath. So for me, this is the same oath, just a different mission.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and New Hampshire congressional candidate Lynn Blankenbecker discuss her policy priorities and approach to tackling our nation's fiscal policy challenges. Thank you for joining the show, Lynn.
Thank you so much, Chase. It was a pleasure to be here today.
It's a pleasure having you on the show. Up next, I'll be joined by the Concord Coalition Policy Director, Josh Gordon. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition Policy Director Josh Gordon. Josh has been on the show before. He directs Concord's research on budget, healthcare, tax policy, and more. He has a PhD from the University of Florida, and he's been with Concord since 2001. Welcome back to the show, Josh.
Pleasure to be here, Chase.
So I think we've got plenty to talk about today, Josh. The Congressional Budget Office keeps pumping out updates and new reports. A couple I wanted to talk about with you today. We'll start with this one. It was an update on economic projections from their previous baseline projections, factoring in some recent legislation. Can you give us a little update or summary of what that report looks like and what it entailed?
Yeah, I think the main takeaway is that the Congressional Budget Office, you know, periodically throughout the year, updates their economic assumptions and projections, and then they update their budget projections to take into account changes that they see in the economy. And this week, their economic projections were updated, but they actually didn't see a need to update their budget projections because they felt like they had gotten it pretty correct in the spring. And the economic projections didn't change much either. The thing I found interesting is that there were a couple of under-the-breath kind of things that the CBO pointed out in their economic projection, which I think is important for the current political debate in the country because there is a lot of talk about how high is economic growth and how long can that be sustained. And the CBO, I think, always puts a sobering reality frame around those discussions that for an organization like ours that cares about the budget and educating the public is always very important.
And just to follow up on that, what were the couple under-the-breath things CBO happened to say?
So I think the main point they made is that even though we had some good growth numbers, especially for the second quarter this year, that they don't think that we will sustain such high growth in the 4% range like we had in the second quarter, and he, meaning the CBO director, Keith Hall, basically says that they think the GDP growth will be good in the 3.1% range for the year, even though we had this kind of spike in the second quarter. And this is actually down from the previous year-long projection for the economy that they had made in the spring, which was 3.3% growth. That's always interesting when, even though we're having good economic numbers come up in the quarter, to have them kind of put it in perspective for where they think it'll end up for the year.
These kind of adjustments, like that 0.2% reduction down in the projection for economic growth, is a figure like that significant? Should listeners really care about that sort of seemingly small change?
I think we need to care too much about the small change. I think it is instructive to learn why these things change sometimes. This one in particular was really a response. First, the high growth was a response to the kind of short-term boost we got from the tax cuts and from the increase in federal spending, but the kind of longer year-long look actually shows lower economic activity from the federal government than they originally expected. And looking down two, three, 4 years down the road, the CBO does not expect very much growth as a result of the tax cut. And I think that's always important. And that kind of leads to the other under-the-breath thing, is that even though anything the federal government does or Congress does has some impact on the economy, the impact is never as great as politicians like to claim. So I think that's also something to keep in mind whenever we talk about tax cuts or spending policy, that we can affect the economy in little amounts for short periods of time, but to do major change over the long term really does require more than a single piece of tax legislation or a single piece of spending legislation. So one of the things the CBO director wrote about is that they currently weren't able to adjust the economic growth forecast for the current trade disputes that our country is undertaking because it's been too short term and it's hard to kind of predict where that is. The CBO director didn't say it, but we can say it. I think there is some concern that the more we engage in these trade disputes or trade wars, the more harm we're going to do to economic growth. And that's ultimately going to be a problem and really kind of short circuit even this temporary period of higher than normal growth. And that is a concern.
Josh, that second under the breath, you know, sort of point that CBO is making there is really interesting to me. I don't know if it was CBO that did it, but I think there might have been another organization that might have broken down a little more closely what was driving that 4.1% spike in the last quarter. Can you talk a little bit about that? You mentioned, you know, maybe it wasn't the tax legislation that really created that big boost like a lot of members of Congress want to get out and champion, that there might have been some other factors there.
Yeah, one of the factors that boosted growth in that second quarter was some extra agricultural trades that were basically done to try and get in under the wire before some of these tariffs and trade disputes kicked in. So there was kind of a temporary boost to output on the trade front, especially in the agricultural sector, because of fear of this trade war. But that ultimately, you know, over the long term, the trade disputes or the trade wars or whatever you want to call them will tamp down our growth expectations for the economy.
And just one last question on this, Josh, before we move on to the next report I wanted to cover, and that is, did CBO give any indication in this report or in others what is primarily driving the reduction in economic growth in the long term getting out beyond the next couple of years?
I mean, it's the same factors that kind of the Concord Coalition always talks about for the long term, that our two main components for long-term economic growth are the growth of the labor force and the productivity of the labor force. And so the Congressional Budget Office and basically every private economic forecaster has us having slower economic growth in the future, and I should put numbers on that. They project 3.1% growth for this next year, going down to 2.4% for 2019, and then going down to about 1.6 to 1.7% for the rest of the, 8 years of this 10-year period that they look at. And that is pretty shocking when we're kind of talking about can we sustain growth at 3 to 4% when most forecasters really project us having economic growth slowing down below 2% pretty consistently in the future. And that really is because of the decline of the labor force and labor force productivity not increasing enough to cover up for that decline in the labor force. And that really feeds into our long-term fiscal challenge where we have so much dedicated in spending, but our revenues are just not going to keep pace because we aren't going to have the growth of the labor force, the growth in labor force productivity, and therefore higher economic, sustained economic growth over the longer term.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking with Concord Coalition Policy Director Josh Gordon about recent CBO or Congressional Budget Office updates and reports, just talking about the recent economic forecast updates. And I want to switch gears here, Josh, to talk about the what CBO calls the alternative scenarios and their long-term outlook. They give you sort of a glimpse, I think, in what reality could be. Can you give us a summary of what this report does, how often they do it, and maybe a quick jump into what it had to say this year?
Well, this gives me a good chance for your listeners to give them some history of the Concord Coalition.
Feel free.
In the late 1990s and early 2000s especially, the Concord Coalition, one of the things we did was look at the Congressional Budget Office forecasts and make what we called a more plausible baseline out of those forecasts. So what this really meant was the Congressional Budget Office is required to create their projections based on certain rules. And the biggest rule is that they're required to look at the laws as they are written and project them out forward for how they would impact the economy, the federal budget, taxes, spending, and all of those things. And especially after the 2001 Bush tax cuts, which were large tax cuts, but most importantly, probably for budget wonks, was that they had an expiration date. And so this made the Congressional Budget Office forecasts very unusually off because they couldn't take into account what really most politicians wanted, which was for those tax cuts to continue forever. But because of the law, having those tax cuts expire, the CBO had to also assume that those tax cuts expired, so the budget deficits did not look as large in the future as they really were based on what we called current policy. So Concord, every three times a year, would take that into account. We knew how much it cost to extend those tax cuts, and we would put out what was called a plausible baseline, and it was a very famous product for us. Then, actually, for good news for everyone, over the 2010 to 2013 period, Congress basically figured out what to do with the Bush tax cuts. They also passed what we call a tax extenders bill that kind of permanently got a lot of expiring tax cuts into the tax code so that the Congressional Budget Office forecasts actually became much more plausible because there were no longer these accounting gimmicks because of the expiration of these pieces of legislation. Now, that might all be confusing, but the point now is that we're now back in a world where we have tax cuts that were enacted that are scheduled to expire, even though the current majority party does not want them to expire, does not expect them to expire, and is, in fact, this fall going to be voting on legislation to extend them throughout the entire budget window. So what the Congressional Budget Office has to do now is they have to do their normal baseline, but then they also do alternative scenarios where they kind of help us, guide us into seeing what the levels of deficits and debt would be if we continued along the current policy track and actually allow these tax cuts to continue for the future.
And Josh, how long has CBO been presenting the alternative scenario? You gave us a history there on sort of Concord's own forecast, but at what point did the Congressional Budget Office start doing something similar?
They started in the mid-2000s doing something similar. I think in part a response to organizations like ours that had to kind of come up with these numbers on the back of an envelope instead of having a real forecast. And there were actually spreadsheets floating around Washington that allowed us to plug numbers in and see what the result would be. And that spreadsheet was very similar to what the Congressional Budget Office used. So at some point, they decided just to take it upon themselves and do it themselves. And then they actually haven't done these alternative scenarios for the last few years with the extension of the Bush tax cuts in 2013, I believe.
So it seems like what might be driving doing the alternative scenarios is something you already mentioned, and that was how we have the potential sunsetting of certain tax cuts and how Congress may not actually want to see them sunset and actually extend them, which then has that interplay between CBO's baseline and what might be more of an alternative reality, and that is changing current policy to, you know, extend those tax cuts. So can you maybe go into some of the numbers there and explain whether these alternative scenarios reflect extending those policies, perhaps what other changes CBO might be anticipating there?
Yeah, so what the CBO did this time is they took their long-term baseline, which is really the foundation of the Concord Coalition's existence. This just tells us what the debt is going to be 25 to 40 years down the road. And, of course, that's what we're most concerned about. We're concerned about the growth in the long-term debt. And under, you know, under current law, where those tax cuts expire and Congress sticks to current law, I like to talk about this as the scenario where the president and Congress leave Washington for a while and everything just continues kind of on autopilot. Under that scenario, by 2038, 20 years down the road, our debt held by the public goes to just under 120% of GDP, which is higher than any level it's ever been and is a pretty dire scenario. So what the CBO then did and said, well, let's take the kind of expressed current policy wishes of Congress and see where that would get us. So they assume the tax cuts are extended. They assume a tax on health insurance from the Affordable Care Act is not imposed, even though it's been scheduled to be imposed a bunch of times, and Congress keeps pushing it out further and further in the future. And then CBO also looked at the spending deal that was reached in the spring, where we're spending more on appropriations than we're supposed to based on the law. We have these caps and the sequester. Congress ignored them in the spring. And so the CBO said, well, what if they continue to ignore them and increase spending on these appropriations programs to roughly keep pace with inflation? And this was the kind of alternative scenario that they created. And under that scenario, you have the debt going to above 150% of GDP. So a pretty dramatic difference there for 2038. But what's really scary is that they take it 10 years beyond there, and that's when you really have some kind of eye-popping numbers, where under the alternative scenario, the debt is going to grow to about 240% of GDP. So it almost triples from the current size of the debt, 78% of GDP, up to 240% by 2048. And then just to make matters a little bit worse, they admit that their models have never been able to figure out what happens under that scenario because it's so much higher level of debt than we've ever been before. And yet they say that they bet that their model vastly understates how high the level of debt would actually get under that scenario if we continued on this current path to 2048. So they say even that tripling of the debt is probably a really conservative estimate for where current policies would lead us.
And we're talking about some really astronomical numbers. I mean, unprecedented level of debt to GDP ratio. How do those alternatives compare to what the baseline projection was? And if I'm remembering correctly, the report has three different alternative scenarios with varying numbers, as you mentioned. Do they give any indication as to which one might be a more realistic alternative than the other? Like, is it a range of less extreme to extreme, or just different aspects of reality that might go into place?
Yeah, I mean, by giving us these scenarios, they are kind of giving us a range. I think what we chose to focus on in our blog post that we wrote on the ConcordCoalition.org website this week is one of the scenarios that most closely represents how we used to do it back when we did our plausible baseline. And so compared to, you know, just the regular current law scenario, certainly in that 2048 range, it is a kind of a huge difference. As I said, that 240 percent of GDP is really eye-popping. But they say the range could be anywhere from under kind of the current baseline of about 200% of GDP to 230% of GDP to 260% of GDP. So that's kind of the range that you can get higher than where we're currently headed.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Concord Coalition Policy Director Josh Gordon discuss different alternative scenarios in the CBO's long-term outlook, as well as some changes in economic forecasts. Thank you for joining the show once again, Josh.
My pleasure.
Next week, I'll be joined on Facing the Future by more congressional candidates. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.